It started as a medicine, and until a few years ago was banned in the U.S.
Not the myth of the grizzled moonshiner, totally uneducated, making whiskey.
We'll talk to a woman who distills the Green Fairy. She's one of a growing number of U.S. distillers, and she started on the wrong side of the law. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Absinthe, also known as the Green Fairy, is a pale green alcoholic drink made of distilled wormwood. It has a centuries-old mystique. Once used as an elixir for everything from pain to anemia, in the late 1800s, it became wildly popular and the drink of choice in France, a handy substitute for wine after grapes were wiped out by a blight and wine became too expensive. But in the early 1900s, the tide turned against absinthe. It was said to cause hallucinations, madness, even death. By 1920, it was banned both in Europe and in the U.S. But its legend never died. Not only its mystique, but the rituals surrounding its preparation, the Victorian water dispensers and sterling serving spoons, make it unique among alcoholic drinks. Now, absinthe is making a comeback both in Europe and the U.S., and one distiller is a woman in rural New York, the owner of the artisan distillery Delaware Phoenix. Her name is Cheryl Linz, and she's as fascinated with the history of what she makes as the process of making it.
There was an article in the New Yorker in like January or February of 2006. Absinthe wasn't even available here in the U.S. But this article was about a fellow named Ted Proe, who was making absinthe commercially at an old distillery in France using antique stills, antique alembics, and how there was kind of a little bit of a resurgence, and that the word absinthe itself kind of went, wow, that's interesting. You could order it online. Okay. Yeah, so I did, and a few days later, this $100 bottle of absinthe showed up on my doorstep.
What did you think when you tried it?
The very first time that I tried it, it was unusual because I actually wasn't sure I liked it. It was different. You know, finally tried it again, changed the water ratio maybe of, because you have to add water to absinthe before consuming it. And all of a sudden I went, oh wow, this is really good. Pretty soon I had half a dozen different brands all from Europe, and here I was milking goats for a living. And, like, this really isn't, this is too expensive of a hobby for someone who's milking goats.
And was that then the next natural progression to saying I should try to make this myself, or where did
That's
it go from there?
That sort of happened. You know, there were starting to be websites devoted to absinthe. Some were devoted to its kind of like drug mythology type of thing, and I steered away from those. And but there were some others where people who had actually discovered bottles of what is called pre-ban absinthe that was made prior to the ban in France in 1915. There was talk on some of the forums that hinted that people might be trying to explore the historical production methods of absinthe, and that's what Ted Bro had been doing, too, with his researches in France. And so I thought, well, you know, it's kind of crazy. But I discovered you could buy a small little Portuguese alembic, a certain kind of still, copper still, that, you know, 1 gallon capacity, minuscule, really, over the Internet, again, for, you know, a few $100. Thought, okay, well, let's give this a try. At the very least, I'll have something to play with.
And Cheryl, was that legal at that time?
No, distilling actually in the home is not a legal activity anywhere in the United States.
Oh, so you're a lawbreaker, too.
I was, yes. There's actually a large number of people out there doing hobby distilling I can't say millions, but certainly probably a few thousand out there. And, they have websites. So obviously, the TTB is well aware of them. But, it's usually professional type people. It's not the myth of the grizzled moonshiner, totally uneducated, making whiskey. It's, average professional people who are doing that. And so they're much more interested in having them go professional so they can collect tax revenues. Eventually, I was friends, it's like, we really don't like this absinthe you bring. These were the commercial brands that I had brought in from Europe, these. And I said, well, here, why don't you try mine? They said, oh, we like this. And I'm like, really? It was kind of a little bit of a revelation that actually I was making something that people liked. And I also had the opportunity to meet with some people who had gone to Europe in early 2006 to make absinthe commercially at a distillery in France. And it was kind of like a community of absinthe people, and they had a chance to try mine. And, they thought, well, Cheryl, perhaps you should be professional, which was a real revelation again to me. And by this time, absinthe had been, well, everybody says re-legalized, but none of the rules have officially changed. What happened was they reinterpreted what the term thujone-free might be based on modern chemical analyses. So that allowed absinthe to be reproduced here in America as well as brought in by legitimate importers.
No, repeat that to me because I didn't understand that. It has to be free of what?
Long ago in the 19th century, late 19th century, early 20th century, there was a lot of problems with alcoholism. But there really wasn't a definition of that, even from a medical standpoint. They kind of knew that, yes, if you had too much alcohol, that was bad, but absinthe, being the strongest spirit on the market, was blamed because it was hugely popular. They were able to determine that there was this chemical, thujone, that was present in one of the ingredients of absinthe, grand wormwood.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, well, this must be the cause. So in 1907, the Swiss banned absinthe. And following that, the Belgians. The U.S. in 1912, the predecessor to the USDA, the Agriculture Department, said, okay, we'll regulate this chemical. That pretty much ended absinthe in the U.S., and so that's where it languished for years. And in 2007, several manufacturers in Europe wanted to bring in absinthe that were totally legal in Europe into the United States. And eventually they started approving some that were made here in the U.S. So this was part of all the history of absinthe kind of being reallowed in the U.S. and part of my the beginnings of my adventure in starting a distillery.
And now you have branched out into whiskey too, correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What drew you to whiskey? The same challenge?
Part of the thing was, originally I was having my first commercial still was a little eight. I couldn't make absinthe in my 1 gallon alembic. I never would have produced enough for anyone. Certainly not at a price that anyone could have afforded. So I had to actually go through and get a larger still. So I got an 8 gallon still. And through that, that was my still. But even then, with a little bit of news, I was out for months. So I now have a 47 gallon Christian Karl pot still, handmade in Germany. It's really an amazing piece of equipment. Steam fired, and the only other spirit that interested me, partially for its historical reasons, but also because of its American reasons, was whiskey. There were three distilleries in the town of Walden between 1797 and about 1830, when Prohibitionist sentiment probably started to arise. And also these men probably got old and maybe their children didn't want to take on that particular business.
Right. So you're sort of carrying on the tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And the types of whiskey that they grew here, they were based on the grains that they grew for bread. So it was wheat and rye. So I was very interested in those types of whiskeys. There hasn't been much demand for wheat whiskey, though I did a few experiments. But I also made bourbon, because that's the quintessential American spirit these days.
Cheryl, has it surprised you that you've discovered this thing that's basically consumed your life now?
It certainly isn't one of those things that you would have expected to happen to you. I always hated those questions in the interviews years ago. You know, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Because I never could imagine, you know, where I would end up. You know, I really didn't think in those terms. I kind of just go with the flow and where things go. And I certainly never imagined to be a craft distiller of anything, let alone, you know, with barrels of whiskey and fermenting and all of these things. But any small business, if you're going to do a craft, whether it's craft agriculture, you know, organic farming, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, animal husbandry, whether you want to do all natural organic, you know, meats, or, you know, you want to make a specialty cheese, all of these things tend to consume your life. You know, it's just the way things are.
Cheryl Linz owns and operates Delaware Phoenix Distillery in Walton, New York. Find out more at DelawarePhoenix.com. Up next, another unusual drink, this one from south of the border. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1206. Isn't the only traditional drink that's coming back from obscurity. We're familiar with tequila and mezcal, both made from the agave plant. But there's another drink made from agave. It's called pulque. It's a mildly alcoholic beverage that has been consumed in Mexico for thousands of years. Beer made it go out of style, but Shannon Young reports pulque is making a comeback.
At the dawn of the 20th century, pulque bars, known as pulquerias, were everywhere in Mexico City. Now, only a few dozen remain. Pulque has a fresh, slightly acidic flavor and a thick consistency. It's either served plain or blended with fruits or vegetables, like a smoothie. Pulque fell out of favor due to a combination of the rise in beer consumption, unfounded rumors about bad production hygiene, and its stigmatization as a drink for the poor. 75-year-old Leopoldo López García is the owner of La Antigua Roma, a pulqueria which has been in business for over a century. López witnessed pulque's heyday in his childhood, and then its slow and steady decline.
It's a real shame, and not because I have a stake in the matter, that an authentic national product like this is disappearing. And the saddest part is how they've disparaged it. It's sad, and that's what hurts us the most. Meanwhile, wine, beer, and other types of drinks are flying sky high. There are very few pulquerias nowadays, even though I believe it's a product that's really less harmful than the others.
The effect of pulque on human health is a topic of interest to Luis Raúl Tovar, a nutrition researcher at Mexico's National Polytechnic Institute.
We are trying to revive, based on scientific facts, a drink that seems to be pretty good.
Tovar and his fellow researchers found that pulque contains a digestive enzyme called phytase, which helps to unlock nutrients found in several foods, among them corn.
And one of the main staples of this country is corn. What drinking pulque does is that having this phytase activity, then, and having your tortillas and chili and beans and so forth, you make much more available iron, zinc, calcium, and magnesium.
Like wine, another alcoholic beverage with health benefits, pulque works best when consumed in moderation. I asked Tovar if people could survive on a diet of corn, beans, chili peppers, basically the Mexican subsistence diet, if it's combined with pulque.
I'm not sure about that, to tell you the truth. It'd be nice if you can eat other things too, you know. But if there is a crisis, it'll be good to have pulque again in the country.
Back in La Antigua Roma, pulque fan Felipe Ramirez tells how the drink helped his family through a crisis in the late 1920s.
My grandfather talks about how he clearly remembers a severe drought in his early childhood. During the shortage of food and water, their diet was based on pulque, caterpillars, and small wild fruits. My grandfather credits pulque with his survival.
While it is possible to get drunk with pulque, it requires relatively large amounts of the filling beverage. Ramirez runs a blog about the remaining pulquerias in Greater Mexico City. It's some of the only publicity that pulque has received in a long time.
I feel that this drink is worth saving so that it can nourish not only our generation and the ones that come after, but so that it's valued as an ancestral drink and as a handcrafted drink, as something that's worth knowing how it's made and why it's still made. It's worth saving so that other people can enjoy what we are enjoying right now.
The publicity seems to be having an impact, says owner Leopoldo López García, who has run La Antigua Roma for 45 years.
It's changed in relation to the clientele. Young people never used to come before. Now, they're the main customers, you know, 20 to 25-year-olds.
But something tells me these 20-somethings may not be drinking pulque precisely for its health benefits. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shannon Young in Mexico City.
That story comes to us courtesy of the World Vision Report. And finally, with all this talk of alcohol, it's a short hop to the cocktail. And a woman who was part of a legendary literary group that gathered for drinks at New York's Algonquin Hotel. Gilles Malkin has more.
Dorothy Rothschild, better known to us as Dorothy Parker, was from New Jersey and had an unhappy childhood. She detested her father and did not appreciate her stepmother to any degree, referring to her as the housekeeper. Sending Dorothy to Catholic school in no way served to encourage any endearment, and she later related she was asked to leave the school for referring to the Immaculate Conception as spontaneous combustion of a sort. By the age of 20, both her parents had passed. Dorothy had been graduated from a finishing school and was earning a living playing piano at a dancing school, working on her writing in her free time. She was an assiduous worker all her life, learning early that it took a great deal of application to come off sounding natural. She submitted poetry to Vanity Fair magazine and was referred by them to a staff writing job at Vogue. She was soon working directly for Vanity Fair, the only female theater critic in New York. Dorothy Parker is perhaps best known for being the female lead and a co-founder of a regular get-together called the Algonquin Round Table. This was a daily gathering of literati, actors, and assorted wits who lunched at the Algonquin Hotel in New York City from 1919 on, and at which the talk consisted of wisecracks, put-downs, word games, witticisms, and practical jokes. This was closer to the idea of spontaneous combustion, as it began as the side effect of a practical joke, but the fun soon attained daily regularity. The group, including at various times such as Harpo Marx, George S. Kaufman, Harold Ross, Edna Ferber, Haywood Bruin, and Ruth Gordon, called themselves the Vicious Circle, and newspaper columns carried their literate loose talk and uproarious wordplay to the rest of the country. It was exclusive, and attendance to the table was by invite only, and the group was even given its own section in the hotel restaurant in which to carry on. Although this scintillating yet nonchalant banter became a hallmark of the 1920s devil-may-care style, eventually this anti-serious public game of fencing with words and personal barb-slinging became tiresome. And as brightly as she shone in it, Parker never took the group seriously, and she had no illusions as to its inanity. Dorothy Parker was assigned to review many plays she regarded as crassly commercial or trite, and inevitably her verbal blade would cut these productions to ribbons, with the result that in 1921 she lost that job, but soon found another at a magazine named Ainsley's, still as a drama critic, but with more free rein for her frank opinions and acerbic remarks. She also wrote for the Saturday Evening Post and the Ladies' Home Journal, and contributed work to the New Yorker magazine for 32 years, rubbing elbows with E.B. White, James Thurber, and Ogden Nash. She reviewed books for them and also for Esquire. And while she wouldn't hesitate to pin unworthy writers to the wall and skin them alive, she had nothing but admiration for the giants of the day, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Lewis, Baldwin, and Albee. Dorothy Parker was a hard liver, a great fan of alcohol, and a free partier, but also used her wits and worked very hard, motivated by adversity itself to use it as a ladder for position in her field, achieving a spotlight in which what she said was read nationally, in a time when women who were able and aggressive enough to successfully compete with men in the media were very rare indeed. But she didn't think of her wit as her worthiest attribute, and continued serious writing all her life. Those who knew her best swore she was deeply romantic, but angry that the world could not conform to her dreams, and from this inner disappointment came her reaction to slash it up with words. Writer and fellow round-tabler Alec Walcott described her as an odd blend of Little Nell and Lady Macbeth. In fact, she participated in a great number of humanitarian causes. Her Hollywood screenwriting earned her 2 Academy Award nominations, but her activities got her blacklisted in 1950. Parker left some remarkable short stories and painted her poetry with a personal blend of depth, humor, and cynicism. Her last poem, War Song, was her favorite, and indeed it shows the person behind the lines. Soldier, in a curious land, all across the swaying sea, take her smile and lift her hand, have no guilt of me. Soldier, when were soldiers true? If she's kind and sweet and gay, use the wish I send to you, lie not lone till day. Only for the nights that were, soldier, and the dawns that came, when in sleep you turn to her, call her by my name. Dorothy Parker died in 1967. Lillian Hellman and Zero Mostel delivered the eulogies. She suggested as her own epitaph, "Excuse my dust." Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.